Blog Talk Radio.
And that is the Project U Radio theme. This is Project U Radio through the Literary Underground, and I'm Lynn Alexander. You know, I hope that tonight goes well. I always hope things go well, but you know, I'm a little bit nervous because we are doing The Cult of Buck tonight, and you know, sometimes these discussions get a little bit heated. When I say The Cult of Buck, I mean, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. I mean, I'm sort of referring to the fact that, you know, there are some very passionate supporters and you know, there are some detractors. That's sort of the way it goes, and that's cool. Really fast, though, I'm going to do Overheard in Pittsburgh, which is a part of some of what we've been doing is a little bit of this poetic voyeurism. And I don't know if any of you guys do this, but do you ever kind of sit somewhere and you know, write stuff down and, you know, just sort of, you know, not eavesdrop. Well, I guess it's eavesdropping, but it's, you know, I suppose if it was really private, people wouldn't be saying it in front of you. But this is Overheard number 36 that I'm up to, and it's Bitch Get a Grip. Bitch Get a Grip, because I'll tell you what it is. You know why you're so miserable? I'm going to do you one better and tell you why, because you are complicating a very simple thing. You look terrible, see, and you hate it. So you walk around with this sneaky vendetta up your sleeve, see, against anyone pretty. You get your digs in, look for vulnerabilities, makes you feel better about feeling ugly. Girl, you got a petty psychology, and I've been watching you rolling my eyes at your whining. I'm going to tell you what it is. You're a bitter bitch. Nasty little spirit, begrudging others, just out there wanting to improve, running circles around you. So let me be the one to tell you what it is. You look like shit and you hate it. So that was Bitch Get a Grip, Overheard number 36 in Pittsburgh, lovely Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And so, yeah, that's one of the things we've been doing. And we've been also doing some open mics and some other things. And I'm going to go ahead and bring Paul Corman Roberts on. Hopefully, you know, he's ready and waiting in our call queue. And good evening, Paul. How are you?
I'm good, Lynn. Thanks for bringing me on. I'm waiting, but I don't know how ready I am. But that's okay.
We just sort of wing it. I mean, you know, I always say it's sort of like freewheeling radio. I mean, whatever happens, happens, you know, however the conversation goes. But, you know, it's one of these topics, though, that, you know, I have to say that, you know, it's what's fascinating to me even more than talking about, you know, the work itself is, you know, the controversy. I mean, just the fact that it's just, you know, people get so passionate and they argue about it, and it's just, it's so easy, you know, to get people going. And, you know, just like, why do you think that is?
I to get them going? How do you mean? I'm sorry. That's, I didn't quite grasp that.
Well, you know, as far as, you know, Charles Bukowski's work, I mean, what,
oh,
and the man, and the myth, and the, you know, the reputation, the things that we know, the things we think we know. I mean,
right.
You know, I mean, I think, see, I don't know, I know things tend to get heated, but my sense of that is that, you know, it's not just about the work, it's that there's a certain divide, you know, a divide, and this came up in some of the discussion on the event page, there's sort of a divide between this, you know, the blue-collar writer and, you know, maybe more of the, you know, elitism, I don't want to use the word elitism, but, you know, that sense that a lot of people relate to certain aspects of his writing because I guess they feel that, you know, he sort of represents, you know, the regular guy, you know, and
right.
not just the regular guy, but the regular guy who sort of, you know, lived his life and did what he wanted to do and didn't really seem to care a whole lot about what people thought about it. And I think people identify with that.
I think, there's a kind of an addendum to that or kind of a first part to that in that for a lot of his life, he didn't do what he wanted to do. He spent a lot of years working in the post office, which is a job he hated. And I think that's where that's the blue collar identification. This was a guy, it was Frank Reardon said it earlier this week quite well that he is, and I can completely credit this and attribute it to Frank, that Bukowski is the poster child for not giving up. And you know, because Bukowski had always wanted to be a writer, going back to the 40s when he was young. It was something that, you know, he felt the call, as many of us do, and he tried his hand at it and dipped his feet in the water. And like most of us do, he got shot down. You know, it was, you know, he lived that life of one rejection notice after another. Right there immediately, there's a history that appeals to a lot of what you would call working writers. And a lot of people see the work that he did in the 40s. Now, granted, there was a time when he did not write for about 10 years and just sort of give, but then got back into it. He got away from it, but then he got back into it. And again, I think that appeals to a lot of people who are writing in the small press. There's a lot of these little stories. Anybody who has worked hard in the small press and had rejection and had success and gone back and forth, there's always some aspect of Bukowski's life that somebody can sort of tap into, you know, because his history is long and it's colorful. He's not just, you know, he is a dirty old man. I mean, he wrote a column called Notes of a Dirty Old Man, and that it's really easy to just sort of classify him as that. But when you look at his overall story, there's a lot about his story alone that's really compelling that the movie Barfly really just doesn't capture, you know, that is not as real. But he achieves the dream when he eventually quits the post office job. He gives up the working life to just dedicate himself full-time to being a writer, and he was able to do that because John Martin at Black Sparrow Press basically said, well, I can give you an advance, and, you know, I can give you an advance on your first novel, and, you know, and I can break it up to where it's $200, do you want me to break it up so you can live on it? And Bukowski, given his situation, was able to live more or less on $200 a month back in 1969. You could still do that. You could live on $200. You could live very cheaply. You'd be very poor, and you'd have to really find a way to make ends meet. But in 1969, it was still possible to possibly support yourself, as long as it was just supporting you, on $200 a month. And that probably sounds pretty insane to a lot of us these days, even in places where things are relatively cheap. But I think in most of our lives we can look back on inflation and the way the cost of living has increased and go like, well, where's anything relatively cheap? You know, there was, you know, in 1969, $200, it wasn't much to live on, but you could do it. If you were creative and clever enough and able to scrape together enough, you could do it. And I think a lot of writers today, I think that's the dream of so many small press writers. They would love to be able to quit their job. They would love to say that their writing could support it. And John Martin, what he did was he had, there was a set amount of an advance, you know, and he was able to break that down to $200 a month. And he just sort of pilfered that out over a period of time. And then, of course, we all know Bukowski goes on to have, you know, an incredible career with Black Sparrow Press. And launches himself and gets bigger and bigger as the years go on until he doesn't need Black Sparrow anymore and he's, you know, a big-time writer or a rock star, as some people in the small press like to say. And I think that's really appealing. I think a lot of writers in the small press don't even feel like they need to hit it big. They don't have to hit the jackpot. They don't have to be Stephen King. They don't want to be Stephen King. They just want to be able to support themselves on their writing alone. And that is as wild a dream today as winning the lottery. In fact, winning the lottery is probably easier than being able to support yourself on your writing today.
Or statistically, and more likely. I mean, you know, the fact is that, you know, you can have all the passion in the world. You've got numbers against you. I mean, you've got, mm-hmm. you know, It's just unlikely, regardless of how hard you work at it. I mean, that's the reality of numbers, and it's discouraging, but, you know, it happens to, you know, it's the way it is. But I think there is that, you know, that aspect of, working a day job, because, you know, honestly, being able to sit home and kind of write and not go to that day job where you're punching a clock and giving your time. I mean, you know, that is to many of us, that would be like the ultimate luxury. I mean, believe me, I mean, I work like 60 hours a week, and nothing would make me happier than to be able to be home and to devote my time to the things that really, you know, that I really want to do. And most of us, unfortunately, can't do that. You know, we can't. But I think some of us even toy with the idea of saying, you know what, if I cut back on this, or if I could just find a situation where, you know, I just have my basic needs met, could I do it? Could I do more of it? You know, and it's tough to think about, but yeah, I think it is part of it. And I think a lot of people, honestly, the feedback that I've gotten today, some of the communication, the emails, the things that go on sort of before we do these shows, there are a lot of people that have this impression that I was interested in this topic because of, you know, oh, are you one of those women that, you know, are going to get into his the way he feels about women and you know, his female characters, and is that your goal, is you just want to, you know, rip him apart, or, you know, and that's actually not true for me. I actually have read quite a bit, and I've also said that especially when he kind of goes a little bit, you know, surreal and crazy, I mean, you know, I don't dislike the work at all. I mean, I don't. So, you know, I'm just putting that out there for the people that, you know, think they're going to get that criticism from me. But I do think coming, you know, not to always try to bring in the female perspective, but I think one of the criticisms that I've seen over the years has been this idea of, you know, his relationships with women and whether they were negative and whether they were, you know, destructive. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's tough to say.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's, I mean, there's a couple of things going on with that. I mean, there was, you know, his relationship with the female's gender, is pretty complicated overall. If you taken as a whole, you know, taken from the larger perspective, it's really complicated. You know, he really, I believe that, you know, there were several times in his life when he really was in love, and he's not always disrespectful, sure. but he's also a volatile personality, and he was a volatile personality who was attracted to other complicated females, or
right.
You know, women who were artists
right.
themselves,
didn't have the best
right.
temperament either, really.
Didn't have the best temperament either. Yeah, he wasn't attracted to wallflowers. He wasn't attracted to the wilting. You know, did he have a lot of cheap sex with hero worshippers? Yeah, of course he did. He achieved, and that's another aspect of him that appeals especially to like the frat boy crowd or the geek boy crowd. The geek boy crowd out in the small press. Like, here's a guy who, let's be honest, wasn't terribly attractive, but still had, you know, really great success with females, and still managed to get laid a lot as a result of that. And that's again part of his cult. It's like, oh well, if he can do it, I can do it, for God's sakes, you know. No, you can't. No, you can't necessarily. You can be better looking than Bukowski and not have as much luck with females or with the opposite gender, because there was a part of him that could empathize. There was a part of him that could engage them and relate to them, and especially with the more creative ones, he challenged them, and they challenged him, and that was part of the chemistry. That was part of the attraction. He was able to work it on many different levels, and to a certain degree, I think it's to his credit that he was able to overcome his, you know, less than attractive looks to achieve that. Is, you know, I mean, he wound up being a, you know, like, you know, a lot of, you know, I mean, it's just, he understood, I think, in a lot of ways what females respond to in terms of what they're attracted to, and he knew that it could go beyond looks, that there was a larger package that could be put, that could be groomed, that could be presented, that would wind up being successful on the intimate level, to be, you know, to be diplomatic about it, you know. But, you know, he was
sure.
just, you know, and all that said, yeah, of course he was a dirty old man. Yes, he was a dirty old man. So what? There's been a lot of dirty old men. He just had success. And the fact, and the fact that he was able to be successful as a writer, that he was, you know, that he had a high profile with it, and that he was eventually able to quit his regular day job to become a full-time writer, made him that much more attractive, especially to creative, artistic women.
Right. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to put 701 on because I'm pretty interested in what he has to say about it. Good evening.
Hello. Am I here?
Hi. Yes, you are. You are on Project U Radio, and you know, as you know, we're. So...
This is Frank Reardon. Yeah.
Yes.
Hello, Frank.
Let me, before I get into the big depth, why I think that Bukowski is the most important American poet since E.E. Cummings, which would make it what, since William Carlos Williams, since like 1930, 20, around there. And my reason being is, I don't know, I'm not going to even get into the A's and B's. I think that Bukowski spoke to the American person in a universal way that no one else ever could. Octavio Paz or whoever else could never, ever come close to the way that Bukowski could to the person, the American person. And maybe because being universal, like, and I was talking to Lynn earlier that how I could say that, you know, like people could, you know, you write a poem and you're so Bukowski. That's going to happen for the next 300, 400 years, because if anybody's had a fucking drink or have had a bad luck with women, they're fucking Bukowski. That's kind of like bullshit in many ways, because I've had a lot of fucking bad luck with women, and I've had a lot of fucking bad luck with alcohol. That doesn't make me Charles Bukowski. And I think he is the most important poet in the last 100 years. And some of his shit, yeah, it's fucking dull. Like, you know, like I don't go to the racetrack necessarily like him, and I don't do this or that, but I don't know, man. He's just fucking important.
But can you explain why you think he's the most important American poet in the last 100 years?
Well, you know what?
He's more universal than any fucking poet.
Okay.
He's a person I could open his pages to and be like, damn, man, I have fucking been there, and I fucking know that. Like, Ginsberg, I have not fucking been where Ginsberg's been, and I will never be where Ginsberg's been. And that doesn't make Ginsberg any fucking better. That made Ginsberg more complicated. And like I was arguing with Lynn earlier about the barber. The barber don't got fucking shit on fucking, like, no, wait, Allen Ginsberg don't got shit on the fucking barber.
One of the things I want to say about that, though, is, and I certainly don't want to get into, I mean, you know, I know we argue about all kinds of stuff, but I think in defense, actually, of what you're saying, though, I think that there has been for a long time this idea that poetry in general or art or you know, anything cultural has been an elite class activity. It's for the leisurely, it's for the highly educated, the trained. You have to be trained to appreciate it. And when you didn't understand something, it was, well, it's because you weren't educated enough. This was something that was not accessible to regular people. And, you know, I think a lot of people do credit him with saying, hey, you know what? This isn't a lofty thing. This is something that is accessible to everyone. Whether you use big words or little, I don't want to get, you know, I know the barber thing, you know, I was being a little bit trying to give you a hard time there, but you know, I do think though that there are many people who say that, hey, whether you love his work or you hate his work, you know, he did sort of shift shift the game a little bit and say, you know what, this isn't something that's for 2% of the population to be part of. This is something that regular people, everybody can be part of. Everybody can reach out and, you know, relate to and connect to, you know. And I would agree with that as far as, you know, his influence and, you know, one of the reasons you would say that he's as significant, you know. That's my
All right. Like Paul was saying earlier, or when you guys were just talking, like, about his relationship with women. But unless you've, like, really, like, been there, like, you can't really, like, say that. Okay, have you both, Paul, have you always had, like, a wife that you've always had a great relationship with? Was there other BS prior?
Hey, man. Oh, well, okay. I mean, sure. There have been great moments. I'll give it that. Okay.
No, prior to you being married, was there, like, bullshit drunk at night, fucking, I'm fucking following the Grateful Dead drunk, I'm fucking an acid-head hippie, prior to that, that drove you fucking insane? Like, I mean, there must have been.
Okay, well, sure, yeah. There were some things.
Right,
yeah,
because,
absolutely.
Like, well, because to me, that's where, like, Bukowski reaches, is those places that, like, you forget about, but not really, because you sit around with, like, you know, and you got your, like, great, perfect relationship that you work so hard to find. But prior to that, where was that other fucking 8 years of, or 10 years, 20 years of fucking insanity prior to that? Or where was
that
guy?
Well, there was,
like,
yeah.
And, like, I was talking to, like, you know, out of nowhere, like, Carter Monroe, he called me last night, and he just said, like, the difference between John Keats and Charles Bukowski is just, like, talking about, like, swine to fucking pearl necklaces. Like, you know, like, you could enjoy all that shit, and the language sounds all great, and that's fine, and we can all dance in the streets, but where's the fucking reality of it all? I want fucking reality, and that's what it boils down to. Give me the fucking reality, or give me the fucking bullshit. Like, because no matter how much I love Howell, it's fucking bullshit. Like,
yeah, but
no,
you live reality. You live reality. I mean,
exactly.
I mean, and I'm not arguing.
And that's why
but
Charles
there are
Bukowski
people that
fucking is telling the truth.
Yeah,
Alan
but there
Ginsburg
are people,
like,
who would say that.
Where is the
yeah,
truth in Howell? You find me one person who's actually lived fucking Howell, and I will fucking.
I don't.
You know,
well, I don't think you have to. I mean, I think for some people, reading is an escapist act, and it's not. You don't necessarily want it to be reflective of your reality.
So then,
I mean,
I don't
have to relate. You know, I can. I mean, I
so you
can
bring
read.
Up the point. Do we want to write poetry just to fucking lollygag in the fucking petunias, or do we want to, like, write
maybe
poetry to say this is what really life is really like? So lollygagging.
Yeah, but
I don't think
I don't think you can honestly say that Howell is lollygagging in the petunias. Howell, and much like Bukowski's poem, you got to remember, Bukowski is not just a poet. He's also really known primarily as a short story writer and a novel writer. He was more of a storyteller. And you have to realize so many of his poems really are just sort of stories that are written in this plain speak. Whereas, you know, and Ginsberg was just, you know, a straight out poet. But I will, you know, I mean, and I got to tell you, Frank, I mean, there's a lot of people of a certain generation who live in on the West Coast or in places in New York who can seriously relate to Howell. There is a subsector that really relates to Howell, although Howell belongs to a certain place and time, as does a lot of Bukowski stuff, lives in a certain place and time. There, but that doesn't mean there isn't a resonance that doesn't appeal down through the generations. Now, you might be right when you say that Bukowski stuff is going to resonate longer because it has this sort of more universal resonance to it, because it appeals,
Paul,
you know, because
I'm
it
not,
has a more working
I'm
class appeal to it.
I'm not disagreeing with you, Paul. I'm really trying, as the show is, with Bukowski, trying to defend his importance as it is Howell, or it is Buffalo Bill with Ian Cummings, or it is Anne Sexton. It's just as important, and it's just as gorgeous. Like, So You Want to Be a Writer is just as important as anything that Chaucer ever wrote, because Chaucer's a dildo, in my opinion, but it's just as important.
Right.
I don't think
you know
they had dildos in Chaucer's time.
I'm going to try to make it a little more complicated.
They hadn't refined petroleum processing quite that well in Chaucer's time to create, you know, the ultimate dildo, I suppose.
I'm not
just
saying
so you
that
know,
Bukowski
I just I'm picking
greatest.
Up.
I'm not
picking up
Bukowski
415 and Frankie.
And that's probably Franco Metro saying I completely love John Keats and Charles.
No, I'm waiting for you. I'm waiting for you to really. I'm waiting for
well,
you.
Let's
to
just hear it. Let's just hear.
You're trying to speak for me right now. You want to hear it?
Hi.
All right.
Can anybody hear me over there?
Can you hear me? Hello.
Hi. We can now.
All right. Cool.
Hey,
what who we got?
Okay, this is Zeke. Am I on the radio right now?
Yeah, go for it, Zeke. You're on the air.
All right. Hey, Zeke. I'm Zeke. I'm friends with Paul and everything. I've been listening to you guys. I got to throw something out there. You know, I don't know if it's that important to see yourself in the artist. I'm a big Raymond Carver fan, yet I don't think I have anything in common with his life or himself as an individual. But I'm still a big fan of that. On the subject of Bukowski, I can recognize where Bukowski is an important writer. I can even recognize his style and see how people can groove on that. But I've never been crazy about his concept, and I've often thought of his work as being gratuitous. I'm also not going to lie to you. One of my turnoffs with dealing with Bukowski is not just his attitude towards women, which I don't share, but also his fans. You know, it's kind of like digging Corey Amos but hating Corey Amos fans, or liking some of the Grateful Dead. But some of those deadheads, forgive me, Paul, are pretty out there. And that's kind of how I feel about Bukowski. I can sort of get into some of his work, and I've read a couple of his novels, but I don't love it. And I don't. I definitely think, if someone's going to drive to my house and try to fight me, but I definitely think he's an overrated artist. And you, Lynn, you used the term that he's a regular guy. I don't see it. I mean, he's certainly blue collar. He certainly did not grow up with like a silver spoon in his mouth like the Lost Generation writers that came before him. But I don't think he's a regular guy because he's so sloven and so dirty and so gross. And, you know, writing about, you know, seeing whores and, you know, whores killing cockroaches. Hey, you just killed my Stevie or whatever the name is. I just kind of always thought his work was kind of gratuitous and just kind of over the top and kind of, you know, I'm saying this, you know, I've said this in the past to sort of antagonize people, but I've often said, if you write about being a scumbag who gets laid a lot, then scumbags who don't get laid are going to think you're a fucking genius. And I still kind of stand by that.
You're a fucking hero, pal. You're a fucking hero for saying that. How boring are you?
You've known me, Paul. You've known me for almost 20 years, Paul. You've known me for 15 years. When it comes to my body, there's always been too many women. There's always been two women in my life.
If you like Charles Bukowski, you're fucking, you don't get fucking pussy. How fucking dull are you fucking, dude? I don't know who you are, but fuck off.
Oh, man, we don't need to go there.
Yeah.
You guys can write me off, Lynn and Paul, but that's fucking dull because Bukowski writes, or not even Bukowski, how about Dan Fonte? How about John Fonte? How about fucking writing the reality of what it is? Because every day that I sit here, there's no fucking petunias popping out of the walls where I fucking sit.
Yeah, but why is it
it's
one or the
like,
other? Why is it either?
It's
I mean,
not
it,
one
you
or
know,
the other, man.
It doesn't
it's
have to be petunias.
It's fucking reality of what life is. It reality
it's your
life.
Reality.
It's
maybe
life is not,
it's
not close
my
to my
reality.
It's what I make my reality after what reality is.
Okay, but let me ask you
because
something. I mean,
you've never read what Love is a Dog from Hell.
Just like everybody else was reading that in college. I read that in college when I was like 19 years old.
Yeah,
everybody else was reading
dude,
that.
Whoever the fuck you are, like, I've never read Dylan Thomas. I've never read any of those motherfuckers.
You should
because
be Dylan
when I've read those fucking people,
you should be Dylan Thomas.
I didn't feel
you
the fucking urinations come out of myself either. Because I've read all that shit, too.
This
and because
fucking awesome.
Fucking,
I said you didn't read Dylan Thomas.
This is like the greatest fucking shit I've ever heard in my entire life. I'm out of here, guys. You guys have a good night, man. Have a good show.
Thanks, Frankie. Sorry.
Thanks, Frankie.
Thanks.
I have to disagree with you on one thing, Zeke. Bukowski wrote a lot about striking out. Bukowski wrote a lot about loneliness and not scoring, and not. It's not. I don't think it's all purely gratuitous. You know, there are those moments when there's, but it's a complete package with. If you really get into it, it's a complete package with him. And granted, yes, there are some things that I get that people find objectionable about what he writes, but you know, when he goes there, it's part of what's real about the ugly blue collar reality and the ugly nature of relations between women and men. It isn't all petunias. It isn't this wonderful kumbaya paradise that goes on like
but
that.
How
Bukowski wrote about
has
that.
This rock star. Okay, but how come Bukowski has this rock star status that, quite frankly, another self-taught American auto writer like Raymond Carver just doesn't have the same, I mean, is it a lack of sex appeal? I mean, why does he not have the same type of inarticulate morons making him into a deity like that last guy? You know, how come he doesn't have the same sort
of
rock star status?
Carver does have a pretty wide appeal. Carver wasn't a poet either. You know, Bukowski went down a different road than Carver did. And Carver comes after Bukowski, really, honestly. He does. And he comes in a different way. He does come, he comes from a similar tradition, and he speaks in, you know, if you look at, I think there's a lot of similarity between their writings, and Carver does enjoy a pretty solid reputation. And it's not, and he's not...
And he's not as purely
sexual either. Whereas Bukowski was willing to go to that place with the sex.
Yeah, you know, and also to go back to what the gentleman was saying too, also regarding the Hal. I actually feel like I have more in common with Hal. You know, in certain sections when you make references to Neil C. And also, I've had there's been some mental illnesses in my family and stuff that struck me, and I've certainly traveled across the country many times. And so, I mean, I actually kind of feel for that. But look at some of the poetry of Gregory Corso and some of these other guys that were really quite amazing. I just feel that every time I meet a diehard Bukowski fan, and I'm not even going to put you in the fan category, Paul, because I think you're very much a scholar. But I've been turned off by Bukowski because of his insane, ridiculous fan worship. You know, I can remember being at a bar in North Beach 10, 15 years ago, and this young man said, I'm here in San Francisco, I'm here to be a writer. I'm like, what do you like? He says, Bukowski. And I'm like, okay. And then I started talking to him about, like, certain Russian authors that I was into at the time. And he was like, no. You know, he was like, I read Bukowski, I like Bukowski, I'm not reading anybody else. You know, and that's sort of like what I encounter when I deal with his fans. You can go on YouTube and get a clip of Bukowski kicking the shit out of one of his girlfriends. You know, I cannot relate to Bukowski. You know what I'm saying?
I'm not saying he was this great, wonderful guy. He was, you know, there's a lot of warts and bruises that go along with it. But the overall context, I mean, you know, you have to understand, and I know that a lot of his girlfriends kicked the shit right out of him right back. I mean, Bukowski got plenty of black eyes from his girlfriends. His women were almost as violent as he was.
I forget the guy's name, but the very first biography ever written about him was written by a guy who knows him. He describes him getting the shit kicked out of him by some woman.
You mean Neely Tchaikovsky?
Yeah.
You mean Neely Tchaikovsky?
Yeah, you know who
I'm talking
about. Absolutely, yeah. So I do know the work. I do recognize how important he is. I do recognize the incredible style that he is. I just don't necessarily think, and this is just my opinion, that he is, as a poet, any better than Gregory Corso, that he is, as a short story writer, as a novelist, any better than Carver and other writers. You know what I'm saying? And for me, he doesn't necessarily have the regular guy quality as much as a, you know, guy like Raymond Carver, who was at age 18, found himself married with kids and having to work crappy jobs to support him. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, and I kind of get it. I kind of get where a fan base turns people off. You know, I get, you know, I mean, I hate, you know, New York Yankees fans drive me crazy. Other obnoxious sports fans drive me crazy.
My father's from Boston, dude.
And Christians, I don't.
I think they're worse.
Well, you got a Red Sox fan online, not me, but Frank out there I know is from Boston, so he's a big Red Sox fan. But I will say, but let's get out of the realm of sports. Let's say you can apply it to religion. I don't hate Jesus. I think a lot if Jesus is a real character and he teaches real things, I think there's a lot to be respected there. My problem is with his followers. I don't hold his followers against him because Jesus had nothing to say about how his followers acted or what they said or did on his behalf, and I don't think Bukowski does necessarily either.
Gandhi said, I don't like your Christians because you're so unChristlike. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's one angle, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean,
the statement I made about the scumbags was designed to antagonize people, and I've been saying it for 20 years. But the fact of the matter is, I do recognize how important he is. I guess I do stand by my statement. I think he's very overrated, and I am turned off by his rabid fan base.
Yeah, and you're not the only one who feels that way, Zeke. You're not the only one I know you're not the only one who feels that way. We talked about that at the top of the show, that there's this huge split. There is not a lot of middle ground with Buick. People tend to either really hate him or really love him, and it is an interesting phenomenon. Let's let Lynn speak. Lynn's got something to say.
I'm actually, I would say that I'm probably the only person I know that kind of is on the fence, because there are things that I've read that I really liked, and then there were things that I could take or leave. And I do kind of understand the frustration with, you know, the devotion and sort of like, I don't want to call it closed-mindedness, but it's sort of like a myopic view of him. And when I said that, you know, as far as representing sort of like the everyman, I mean, I certainly don't mean to suggest that most people relate in that sense and live the way he lived. But I guess, I mean, maybe accessibility of themes of some of the subject matter, you know, as far as being things that are, you know, understood and you know, accessible to regular people. I mean, I do think that there are people that appreciate that about him. But, you know, the whole, I mean, I think there's also this confusion with the persona. I mean, I think that poets do a lot of that. I mean, I think that they get very involved in the persona and the lifestyle and what they perceive to be the lifestyle of people like that. And there's something about it maybe that they want to emulate. I don't know. And I guess the other thing about whether it speaks to your reality, I mean, certainly a man getting laid, I mean, it doesn't speak to my reality. I mean, I don't know that, like I said earlier, I don't know that I want that from my writing. I don't know that I want it to be about what I experience. I don't know that I want it to look like my life. You know, I mean, I live my life, you know. You know, I don't know that it needs to do that. And this idea about, you know, the petunias and stuff, you know, I don't know that that's such a terrible thing. I don't know that it's terrible to be transported to, you know, other places that are very different than your reality. I don't know that I think that's a positive thing. But, yeah, that's all. That's. You know, I am kind of on the fence, which is why this fascinates me, because I've had horrible heated arguments with people on one side and horrible arguments on the other. And I just kind of look at both sides and try to, you know, make sense of where the other is coming from on it, you know.
I like early Hunter S. Thompson, but I really hate the kind of redneck bully asshole he became. You know what I'm saying? And to this day, you know, I often ask my friends why do liberals like Hunter S. Thompson? If you were a country singer with the same exact personality, you'd hate him. Because, you know, he ran around carrying guns. He was a bully. He was an asshole. I don't understand the sort of monster that he morphed into. But I guess that's another topic for another show. But yet, Hell's Angels and his early work is still outstanding. It's just, I really hate the person he became. And his Hunter S. Thompson fans are just as dangerous and just as passionate as Bukowski fans. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I mean, but what do you think about the persona issue? I mean, do you think that in some cases, and I'm not pointing fingers, or I'm just putting it out there, do you think there are times where people, you know, romanticize some of these, you know, that and there's something about it. I mean, you know, women do that. I mean, like you said, you mentioned Tori Amos fans. I mean, you know, women do that with Sylvia Plath. Women, you know, men, every people latch on to certain personalities, whether it's Jim Morrison or whether it's Ginsberg, and they sort of, I don't know, there's something about what they perceive about their life and their persona that speaks to them. And, you know, maybe they want to emulate aspects of it. I don't know. I mean, what do you think there's some of that going on with these, like, followers?
I think if I may call you Lynn, I think absolutely. I think people do get turned off
by how rabid a fan base is. I mean, I've lost on Facebook, I've lost more friends by saying, you know, I hate Star Wars than I have for any of the political statements I've ever made. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it was a silly kids movie. But the fact is, I've seen so when people have something that they hold sacred, hold dear. I'm a Jack Kerouac fan, but yet I can recognize that Jack Kerouac was a one-trick pony. I don't get really angry when I meet people who hate Jack Kerouac, which are pretty easy to meet. You know what I'm saying? So I mean, I just think
I hate
think
Jack
rather,
Kerouac. I think on the roads, a really mediocre piece of work myself.
Okay, and for me that kind of changed my life, and I try to read it every couple of years. But the fact of the matter is, I'm not going to take that personally, Paul. I still want you to be my editor. You know, I still value our friendship. But that's what happens with opinions, right?
I get it. You know, I do get it.
Yeah, you got to. And like I said, as much as I can talk about the influence that had on the 16-year-old me, I can also read it at 26 and again at 36 and see the flaws in the book. And also, I can also recognize the guy who was a one-trick pony, and his later novels are just unreadable because of it. So yeah, I mean, I can totally recognize that, and you can have a fan. Like, I'm a big influence of a writer that nobody. I'm a big fan of a writer named David Markson, who's a big intellectual postmodern writer. Nobody else knows who he is, but still, if somebody came by and said that guy's a pretentious windbag, I'm gonna accept that and just sort of move on. You know, people have to kind of accept their opinions are just their opinions. You know, that's why political chat shows have degenerated into what they've become. You know.
They have, you know, and very divisive. I mean, there isn't really a whole lot of effort to, you know, really see where people are coming from with it, you know. And like I said, I mean, that's why it's interesting to me, because it's a devotion that I can't really claim to understand, that I'm trying very hard to understand. I mean, you know, honestly, but I don't. There are a lot of things about it that you know are perplexing, and you know the thing is in back to the women, you know, the question of you know the women and you know things of that. I mean, people, you know, there's always been that. I mean, there are always writers where people have sort of looked at the personal life and sort of made causes about it, you know. I mean, we can see, like, with Ted Hughes, for example, you know, people that where people, you know, have sort of made it political, you know. Your attachment to a particular writer says something about your politics, really, you know, in a way that's unfair, you know.
Well, you know, Norman Mailer, if I may interject, Norman Mailer stabbed his wife because she said, "You're not a better writer than Dostoevsky," you know. But I mean, Norman Mailer does not have the cult influence, and nobody kind of reads Mailer anymore, and he doesn't have the big cult rock star status that Bukowski has. And you know, he's better looking than Bukowski. I just don't totally understand it. And yeah. I'm sorry.
Well, we try to understand it, because it does seem fairly random. I mean, I think there have been other writers who have captured the working class experience, and you know, mm-hmm. and you know, Bukowski is, you know, I characterized him earlier as a short story writer who frequently disguised his stories in his short stories as poems. You know, he would write these long poems in this plain speak that really were just short stories. But not all of his poems are like that. He was capable of flights of lyricism that a lot of short story writers aren't capable of, and that's because he spent a lot of time in the poetry world. But because that's part of his history, he tried to be a short story writer first. Even when he was a young man, he recognized that fiction was where the money was, and that poetry was sort of, you know, was sort of a poor man's game, was sort of a hobbyist game, you know. But he really couldn't change who he was, and so he wrote poems, but his poems were capable. But as he spent time, and he spent many, many years doing it, he got better at it, and you can find Bukowski poems that are just lyrically wonderful, and there's a surprise. Lyricism to it, but once he got back into fiction, once he got back into novel writing, he left a lot of that behind. He really did, and
yes.
Ambitious, and he himself. And let me tell you, Zeke, I'll finish on this.
No,
Bukowski himself said, and he said this: "I am not the best. I never was the best. I was just the most persistent. And I don't know that that makes it right that he's rewarded years later with all this rock star cult status, but that is kind of what he was going for, and he kind of and he got it. And, you know, it is what it is. I mean, and you can't – there's no formula for that. There's no – you can't quantify that sort of a thing.
I think you did hit the nail on the head of saying that if there's a message to his life, I know his tombstone says don't try, is don't give up. If writing is what you feel in your heart, keep on doing it. I do think he hit the nail on the head. However, again, we can look at other writers like Carver and other writers who kind of did the same thing. You know, because I've had agents say they're not going to even look at my work because I don't have a master's. You know, so yes, I do admire Bukowski for doing that, but he's not the only one in the game that did that. But I do realize, yes, he does need to be applauded for that too, yeah.
Yeah, and there's, and you know, and that said, the man was an incredible asshole. He really was. He was, and Neely Tchaikovsky will even say that. I mean, he did this when they had their literary magazine, you know, Laugh Literary Man, The Humping Guns. And told this story, and they would go through their slush piles, and you know, and Bukowski would write these rejection letters to these young writers who would just say, you don't have it, you're not good enough, and yes, take it personally. You know, as an editor, I couldn't do that. I'm never going to be one to discourage. But you know, but that was just part of his hard scrabble, I don't care, I have to win out ambition. And I hate to say it, but there is a lot of writers out there that really appeals to.
Yeah. I'm glad it doesn't appeal to you, and that does not appeal to me either. You know, I just
that particular attitude doesn't appeal to me. That doesn't mean I can't appreciate his writing, and that does I'm also aware also that Jack Kerouac was able of incredible. I mean, I still do think that, you know, October and the Railroad Earth is a fabulous piece of work by Kerouac. That said, I don't get on the road.
Okay, that's fine. You know, I was gonna say something that Bukowski fans like to tell me a lot is Bukowski went to an Allen Ginsberg reading. He was drunk, and he basically said to Ginsberg, "You never wrote another decent poem besides Hal." And Ginsberg just put up with it, he didn't say anything. But you know, if he tried doing something like that to Gregory Corso.
he would have. Here's the thing. I don't believe for a moment Buick would have ever tried that with Corso. He would have known what he was in for if he had gone that route with Corso. That was asking for a straight up scrap. And while Buick might have been Buick loved to talk about himself as a pugilist and a scrapper, I don't know that he wanted to go down that road with Gregory Corso.
Yeah, I do think that that guy though that talked about reality. When or even that young man I met at a bar 15 years ago, when you do start having life experiences, you know, I don't have the same experiences with women that Bukowski did. But you know, I've been a bouncer and stuff like that, and I've gotten into fist fights, big drunken brawls, and yes, I have experienced that where you wake up and your face is covered with blood, and you wake up out of your hotel room and stuff. I've experienced all that, and yeah, that does ring true. And it does ring from somebody who's actually experienced that. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying he's a piss-poor writer, like if you guys were talking about James Fry or something. But I do, I'm kind of indifferent to his idolatry. But at the same time, you know, it really helped that Jack Kerouac was so ridiculously good-looking. You know, in the picture of him in his khakis, it could have been a male model. I mean, that's kind of the thing that has been selling on the road for decades is the fact that Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy both look like a couple of male models. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I don't know. Kerouac in his later years wasn't that good
agree
looking.
To me, you don't agree with me.
No, I agree.
Okay.
Kerouac and Neil are like maybe the two guys I feel bisexual for. Those guys were gorgeous. And it does have its privileges. I've tried some of the stuff Neil does in that book.
I don't know that I can tell you what a good looking man is. I can't tell you what an ugly man is, though. And Bukowski was an ugly man.
Yeah, he was exceptionally ugly. But no, it is interesting. I'm enjoying this conversation. But I guess then how do I? Am I on the fence like Lynn, or I just say that I respect the music, the writer. I'm just not a fan of it. Is that what I have to say?
Well, you know, what I would say, though, is I would say, yeah, he's, you know, he's he's not my top 10, though. I mean, I can, that's where I sort of stand. Where, I mean, I can, you know, I think if there, I could think of probably 10 people I would be fanatic about before, you know, I guess what I'm saying is that he's not the top of my list, but I don't, you know, I don't discount, you know, the opinions people have. I don't discount the influence. I certainly do feel that there's legacy there, and that, you know, but whether it's deserved, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Like I said, he's not even probably in my top 20, I would say. So it's hard for me to say, you know, it's, you know, if that's being on the fence, then that's on the fence. You know, I think there are certainly a lot of people that are, you know, if I had to defend and fist fight over, I think I'd fist fight over the merits of probably a lot of other people. But that's not to say that, you know, it's without merit either. I just, like I said, he's not, probably not in my top 20, but, you know, that's sort of how I feel about it. And like I said, I hear these, you know, these arguments have been going on, you know, forever. And, you know, I just sort of look at both sides, and there's just, it just gets so heated so quickly. I mean, that's what's curious to me about it is the defense. I mean, it's like you're either with him or you're against him, you know, and it's, you know, but that's what's interesting.
When that guy said he was the most important writer since E. Cummings, you had a big reaction. So you obviously don't feel the same way.
I don't. You mean me? No, I don't. I don't.
Oh, Paul. No, it was Paul. He had a big reaction.
Oh, Paul. Yeah, Paul.
I'm sorry.
I don't want to speak for Paul.
My reaction to...
When he said that Bukowski was the greatest American writer since E.E. Cummings, you had a big reaction.
That wasn't me who said that. Frank Reardon said that.
I know, but you had a big reaction to him saying that.
I thought that was a bold claim. He said greatest American poet, and in terms of poetry, I don't agree. I thought that was a bold claim. I don't diss Frank's position on that. You know, Frank. I think there's a lot of people who feel the way that Frank does about, you know, Bukowski's work as a poet. And I think Bukowski's work as a poet is, you know, maybe even above average. I would disagree that he's the greatest American poet of the last 100 years. I don't buy that. But that, you know, I definitely would rank Corso above Bukowski in terms of pure poetry. But I do think Bukowski is one. I think he's one of the top short story writers of the last 100 years. I do rate him very high with, as your icon Carver, you know, they're very different. They have different sensibilities, but they do come from similar generations, and I think they have a lot of sensibilities that are similar, and a way of speaking simply and basically to very basic human truths that we miss in a lot of mainstream work. You know, that you don't necessarily get a lot of in the big mainstream press, where, you know, you have these really overblown rhetorical flights of fancy that leave a lot of, you know, a lot of simpler people behind. I get the resonance, you know, because you have to admit, Carver appeals to a lot of people in the same way. I think he does.
Right.
Yeah, you don't meet anybody who wants to be a writer who isn't a fan of Carver also. Carver is pretty influential. He's lived in Seattle for a couple years too, and he's really, you don't publicly put down Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, or Raymond Carver. It's pretty much in that, that order. But yeah, it really is. Carver's taken really seriously and passionately as a Pacific Northwest writer, and if you've ever spent any time up there, he really kind of captures that too, just like other writers capture other cities that they're from. He really kind of captures that region, I think, too. Even though not all his books take place there, he does capture that type of community. If you ever get a chance to spend some time up Pacific Northwest.
Right. I'm gonna bring Don on if you don't mind, because I
thank you. Thank you for keeping me on as long as you did.
Yeah, no, I mean, I appreciate it. I just, you know, figure we'll see what a couple other people have to say. Good evening, Don. How are you?
Slow and stupid.
Oh.
No, not you, Don.
How
are
you?
Not
it's
stupid,
always,
Don.
Always good to... So are you.
Hey, you don't.
What do you think?
You simply don't know me well enough.
I know enough, sir. I know enough.
I wanted to bring up something here. You know about immediacy. Uppy Sinclair was an immediate writer, too. And there was a Finnish poet by the name of Pentti Sarikoski who was a medium. And what they shared was this back and forth fight between their alcohol and their text. And they had a real rough time. Bukowski had what, acne?
Really bad acne.
And then
boils, deep skin boils.
And it pitted his skin, and he had to wear a beard, and there was the thing about World War II, about being cast out of the army as a 4F, and then, traumatic experiences, and
right,
he gets away with it by sublimating it and writing it out. But it still doesn't function for him in terms of real world sustenance, which I don't know.
That's one of those aspects. I talked earlier about aspects that you could really tap into with Bukowski. There are aspects of his life that are just resonant and appealing in that way. I had that horrible deep skin acne when I was a teenager, deep boils. It made me very unattractive, you know, and I would spend hours in a mirror in the evenings, you know, really abusing my skin, you know, trying to get all that goo out of my face and, you know, I wanted to just cut it out and I couldn't do it myself. So then I would go to these, you know, dermatologists who would, you know, try to do it, but then they would always come back and it was just a losing. And I just, you know, when I learned you had to grow older, you have to grow out of it, and you realize these are going to be scars that you wear with you your life. That's one of the great lessons, is that we have to learn to live with our scars. They won't go away on the inside. So why do we fight them so hard on the outside? But it takes us a long time to learn those lessons, you know?
And I don't think that Charles Bukowski, was able to do that. I have a little bit of... I don't know whether or not to classify him as a lumpenproletariat or working class, because, you know, post office and...
Yeah.
I don't know, because I used to throw mail. And,
oh, you did? You worked for the? Did you work for the post office?
Yeah, and I'm not gonna bring up irritants, but his portrayal and what happens is his is unique portrayal. Ooh. But I'm glad that he does not use words, that his diction is not peppered with big words. Academic poets tend to do that.
I know that that's probably another discussion we could probably have, because I think that there is, in fact, I think Frank made reference to the argument we had about that today, that the idea that language should be accessible, should be easily understood. And my argument with that is that I think that there's a little bit of a presumption that regular people, you know, I don't want to say that it's talking down to people, but I do think that there are people that do enjoy language in all walks of life. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't have a problem, I guess, with big words, you know, and I know that people do, and people, you know, seize on that as being an elitist or an academic, you know, tendency. But on the other hand, you know, when you love language and you love words and the sound of words, and, you know, it's sort of like when you love wine or you love good food. I mean, you know, you want fresh herbs, and you want that experience and to be submerged in it. And I don't know, but we probably could probably have another show about that easily.
Easily.
And I apologize, we're almost out of time. And And we have, and I don't know who this, we have just a last caller if they want to just sort of throw something out there, but it's I don't have an area code for you, but if you want to throw something out before we run out of time.
Is that Tim Murray?
Is that you, Wendy?
It's what happens when you start drinking that 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I guess. I don't know.
Don?
Yes, sir.
Don, who? There's something about fresh herbs, man.
Fresh herbs.
Now.
Don, okay. Man, who are your top 20 favorite writers?
Top 20? Oh, I'm not doing a list on this show.
Can we settle for three? Can we negotiate down to three?
Yeah, three is fine from each of you though.
Well, see. You'll make fun of me, but I happen to like Annie Dillard. I happen to like obviously I like Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes. I'm not ashamed to admit that.
So that's three right there.
Well, okay. Well, sorry. Well, I have more, but, I'm just off the top of my head. I mean, Jane Austen. I mean, I'm more a traditionalist, and I'm not embarrassed by that, but, yeah.
So your reading habits are really boring.
Yeah, pretty much they are. And I'll say that, Forrester. I tend to read some very, very dry, boring, put-you-to-sleep stuff. I do. Yep.
I'm sorry to cut you off, Lynn, but we're almost at the end of this episode of Red Fez Radio. Paul Corman Roberts, with just a few seconds remaining, could you please tell us your top three favorite Arthurs?
Arthur Schlesinger. Who was the guy who wrote Death of a Salesman? It was Arthur Miller.
Arthur Miller.
And then the original Arthur, who was the alcoholic, played by Dudley Moore.
Dudley Moore. And
yes.
That's wonderful. Well, it seems to me, Paul Corman Roberts, on this episode of Red Fez Radio, Paul Corman Roberts, it seems to me that your interests are a lot more interesting than Lynn Alexander's.
Absolutely, they are.
I disagree. I disagree to the nth degree with you. This is the literary underground, by the way.
Oh.
which is a larger collective of which we feel like connected and very fuzzy and warm with Red Fez Radio. Don't get me wrong.
Oh.
We sleep under the same blankets, my friend.
Oh yeah,
yes, sure.
Don.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
You didn't include your top three yet.
Carver, Julia Vinograd, and maybe Kay Ryan.
I don't want
wow, that's a good,
about
good
this,
selection.
John. I want definites here. I mean, this is a show where there's a lot of definites.
Well, then,
top three is hard, man.
Definitely on the fence, I'd say Kay Ryan.
Okay.
Kay Ryan's brilliant, though. She really is.
I'd like to hear Tim Murray's favorite.
Yeah, Tim, what's your top three, brother?
Oh man, I don't think I can answer that question. I think Studs Terkel.
Yeah. Huh? Interesting.
Studs Terkel.
Yeah.
Well, actually, he was a documenter of other people's language. Studs Terkel. I don't know. Dr. Seuss and that guy who wrote the dictionary.
Oh, that guy.
You know, the thesaurus or whatever.
Noah Webster.
Webster. Not real.
Like
not a super prosaic individual. I can't go along with that.
Me too.
I like, hey, how about, man, what about people who are actually living and breathing in the small press world right now, man? Who are some of your favorites right now?
Right, and just so we are in archives, but I'm sure
you
know that.
I'm sorry.
That's fair.
That's cool, just so you know. You mean your question is who are some of our favorites in small press, the people around
us? Excluding the really bad Bukowski imitators, like, Frank Reardon. Or, he knows I'm Josh, and so I can say that.
Well, Don did mention Julia Vinograd, who is a long-term, a very long-term small press writer who's been right for, pushing almost 50 years now. Yeah, just, oh, well, 40 years of hard work in the small press. My favorite that's living and breathing in the small press right now is Miss Sarah Fran Wisby, who writes like a flash fabulist, which is a style that I would really love. You know, I find myself trying to emulate that style of writing, which is so captivating to me. But I think her book Viva Loss in 2008 was just the greatest poetic. Best poetic release of that year, and I can't wait for her next book, which I have no idea when that is. But to all of you out there, I cannot recommend Sarah Fran Wisby enough.
Right. Wow. No, I know you feel that way about her.
Lynn Alexander.
Who are my favorites in small press?
Living and breathing people. You know?
Yeah, obviously I love John Swain. I mention John Swain everywhere I go. He knows it. Everyone around me knows it. I fell in love with his work before I ever met him or talked to him, and I've just been sort of enchanted by the guy ever since. So that's no secret. Everyone kind of knows that. I have to say that there are... just so many people. I mean, people do different things in different ways. I mean, like Michelle, for example, I love her candor and the rawness that she brings to her writing. And then there are people like Felino Soriano that are just so esoteric and out there. And it's and I love reading that too. I mean, it's hard because, you don't want to pick your friends and, obviously Paul Corman Roberts, I've always loved. I've always loved what he does, his work. He's a hack.
Oh, absolutely.
No. And then there are people that are unexpected. I mean, that I love, like Mel Bosworth. I mean, people like that.
Love Mel. Fantastic.
I mean, he writes beautiful things. I mean, he really does. It's, things that you just sort of stop and, really just blows my mind. Michael McAllen, is someone else that, is maybe underappreciated, that I would like to see, read a lot more, his work out there. Just so many people, it's tough. But I could fill the next hour, I'm sure, with
thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, I know. What about you, Tim? I'd be interested in some of your picks.
Oh, this guy, I read a little bit more of his stuff all the time. I think he's been in the latest issue of Red Fez, but Kevin Ridgway.
He does some
good work. Iris Applequist or whatever.
Candace,
I believe she's good stuff, man, but I don't think she likes me because I think I sent her a friend request on Facebook and she never responded, so it's like, it's like that cyber way of saying just back off guy or whatever, but her work is really good, and those are the two people that I can think off the top of my head that I enjoy running into in small press land. I don't think Brian Puget gives himself enough credit either for being a very funny writer, and I saw him perform in Cleveland, and he's a damn funny guy.
Yeah, he is.
He is.
And the thing about Brian is that he really does keep his writing and his creative work. I mean, he has a way of sort of keeping that on the back burner, when he's at these events and things. He's always the publisher first. The publisher first and the writer and artist and comic and, artist, is sort of like a footnote when he talks about himself, And Kevin Ridgway, I mean, he's hilarious. I mean, I don't know if you caught his story about like the inflatable beach balls and everything, but, he's another, unexpectedly but very funny person,
Kind of attracted to him, not in like a sexual way, but like in a art, a writerly way.
Right, Don. Do you have any? You have any favorites out there? I mean, I know you're surrounded by, great talent. I mean, I know we met up at that Priya that time. Who are some of the people that you that are actually around writing today among us?
In Sonoma, there are three people that seem to be important. One is Chris Giolacini, another is Lynn Marie DeVincent, and the third is Ted Sachsauer. Ted is a veteran and deals with trying to put up with his experiences in Vietnam and speaks for a lot of vets. Lynn Marie is late coming to writing and is sort of a pixie-ish latecomer. And Chris Giovancini is a professional landscape person and does a lot in terms of nature and plant life, you know, extended metaphor and what do they call it? Illuminations. Sudden.
Of plants.
No, sudden.
You mean of landscapes or?
Plants pastoral. And landscapes. Pastoral.
Okay.
But conceits too, and extended metaphors and. But some also other of his stuff is aperçu, haiku written in more than just the restricted syllables. Sort
right.
of an American version of haiku.
Right. Well, there's haiku that we come to learn in school is, you know, the 575, and then there's the art form, you know, certainly of the haiku and the haiku moment and the there's a different way of looking at haiku that people don't always, you know.
Well,
you know,
that's why I included the word aperçu. It's a grasping, sudden grasping, and then letting go and being illuminated in that moment.
Right.
And that's what he deals with. It's very powerful. Yeah, that's
right.
About it that I can think of offhand.
No,
Alexander, are you still doing landscaping?
Am I still doing landscaping? Not lately.
Oh.
And I do apologize. You know, on the East Coast, it's almost 1 o'clock in the morning, and I always start crabbing about, you know, how early I get up and how delirious I start to become conversationally. So I do apologize to Don if, you know, I was, trying to make sure I understood what he was saying. And do I still do landscaping? No. In fact, Roger was supposed to come out here and help me out with some of that. And he had me Western Union some money, and he was supposed to hop on a bus, and I was supposed to fill the lawnmower. And, you know, it was all a go, and he didn't make it. So, yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that. I won't bring that up again.
Tim Murray, I need to ask you how you're feeling about your Chicago White Sox this year.
Oh, yeah. I believe, as a matter of fact, tomorrow night, ladies and gentlemen, a shameless plug, we're doing an all-sports episode of Red Fez Radio. Paul Corman Roberts, the answer to that question is I believe we will have third place locked. We will have it clinched by the end of May.
You can thank your fabulous relief pitching for that too, I think.
Well, no bullpen, sir. No bullpen. all right. A lot of heartache, you know, but I'm used to it. I kind of like the beatings. It's like paying for a woman to, you know, step on you with high heels or something, you know. And I don't know anything about that. Never actually.
Me neither.
Sorry.
Then, just after he was born, I was waiting for him to be released from the hospital where he was born.
Uh-oh.
He didn't want to let him out because he seemed to be Chinese.
Oh. I don't even know what that is, but I guess
I think that's a case of Red Fez radio breaking out.
I think so, but I think I think we need to sort of end up, you know, wrap it up for the night because we are in overtime. I do want to thank Don and Kim Murray. And,
and that call off, Lynn.
we do appreciate the sound experiments that we are always treated to on this show. You know, that was delightful. And thank you, everybody. I mean, you know, it's not an easy discussion to have. I kind of thought it, I sort of anticipated a little bit of tension. And, you know, I hope we all sort of look at these discussions for what they are, which is to sort of sit down as grown-ups and talk about our opinions and agree to disagree on certain things. And, you know, and part as friends with maybe a little bit of, you know, a little bit of understanding where other sides are coming from. That's sort of my goal with these little back and forths that we have on here. I mean, it's certainly not to encourage animosity and divisiveness and hard feelings, and you know, which can happen. It's you know, the spirit of the intention here is to just talk things out a little bit, and you know, that's what we try to do. One of the things we try to do with Project U Radio and our topic shows. I believe next week we're back to we're doing the open mic, which
sounds
we
good to me.
Yeah, we sort of do sporadically, and we've been doing our overheard pieces and our poetic voyeurism and found poetry. So, you know, certainly if you come across something you'd like to read or share, even if it's the back of your Kraft macaroni and cheese, you know, if it speaks to you and it's interesting, then we'd love to hear about it. So I will let Paul have the last word and say goodnight to Don, and then we will wrap everything up.
Oh, well, thank you. Just a big thanks to Frank and Frankie and Zeke and Don and Tim for calling in, and Lynn, thank you so much.
Thank you, and good night. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.